Okay, tonight we are about 6 days before Rosh Hashanah. The topic is, do you have to be afraid on Rosh Hashanah? That's the question. Okay, so I want to start off with a video, a very interesting video about concerning the son of Hamas, Musab Hassan Yosef, who has been called also the Green Prince, who was taken into Israeli custody. Through there's a couple movies. He actually has a couple movies about him. There are books about him. But basically, he went from being the son of Hamas to becoming a spy for Israel. And he's going to share. The focus is, why did his views about Israel change? And it's an interesting study on change. Obviously, change is a major focus on Rosh Hashanah. So without further ado, we're going to go to the proverbial video tape. Okay, hold on. Oh. Here we go. Share screen. Here we go.
When I was conditioned in my society to hate Israel as the ultimate enemy of the Palestinian people, an enemy that we blamed everything on, and we still blame. I saw Israel as the devil. But when you go on a journey and you have direct observation and you have experience with what so-called enemy, your truth is going to be superior because it's first-hand experience. It's not coming from the mullah, from the imam, from the sheikhs. It's not coming from the politician. Actually, the ones who propagate and sell the idea that Israel is your enemy, basically blind public from seeing the actual and true enemies and true criminals of the Palestinian and Arabian public. Which is basically the religious authorities and the politicians. So it's much easier for them to blame everything on Israel, to get away with their corruption, with their oppression, and with their abuse of power. And people are believers, you know, they just believe and they become part of that propaganda to the point that someone will go and blow themselves up to that extreme, to that extent. So when, in my case, as individual, I decided otherwise to experience things and to learn more. So I put my hatred on the side and my education, my conditioning, everything that I took or inherited from the society, from family, from my parents, from the religious authorities on the side, and make sense of what I see directly. And little by little, I start to learn that Israel is not our enemy. You know, Israel is just another nation, people, children, women, elders. And they're seeking life. They're not seeking death. And basically, they have the birthright to be in that place, as I had the birthright to be in that place. And the idea to uproot a nation and throw them in the sea, children, women, human beings, and kill them because they are different, or because, you know, the politicians say they don't belong here, or the mullah or the religious authorities say this is an Islamic land, or this land belongs to Allah, not to the Jews. You know, this is the human delusion, and this is a lie. There is a whole new generation in that country, wonderful people, that they have the birthright to be there. And nobody can strip them that right. But again, you know, this is a long journey to come to this realization and to accept this truth, which is basically the truth of tolerance and coexistence. Nowadays, it's proven, you know, that the idea of destroying the other because they are different, because they believe in something else, because they have a different lifestyle, or have a different belief system, is a dead end, you know? It has been 70 years in the Middle East, and where are we at right now? You know, it's a dead end, and people just suffer, and they will continue to suffer if we still believe that this is a possibility.
All right. Have you guys seen any? Have you guys heard the Green Prince, the Musab Hassan Yosef, before?
No, first time.
Yeah, he's an interesting guy. Obviously, he's a person who has to be concerned about his personal security, because obviously the Hamas organization is not happy about him. Yeah, okay, so let's get down to it. All right.
Is he the guy whose father was like a prominent member of Hamas?
Yes, he's the lead.
Okay.
Yes, his father is...
I think I may have heard of him then.
Yeah, Sheikh Hassan. He's the head of Hamas for the entire,
Right, I think I heard something about that.
Yeah, he's so that's what, so you can imagine that Thanar is the number one Hamas, the son of the number one Hamas guy in the West Bank, now is a supporter of Israel. So, all right, so let's get to some questions. All right. Okay. What change or aha moment did Musab Hassan Yosef, the Green Prince, son of Hamas leader Sheikh Hassan, go through? And why? He said it in his interview. What change did he go? What was it? He had an epiphany, he had an aha moment, he had a light bulb moment, whatever you want to call it. What was that moment? He described it.
He referenced the birthright. He referenced two things, and I'm not entirely sure what he meant by birthright. Maybe it's in connection with the second thing, which he said, which is that there's children, parents, elderly people in Israel, and you can't just throw them into the water. And then he kept referencing the birthright.
That was part of his second part of his presentation. But in the earlier part, even within the first minute, he shares that there was a particular moment in his journey where he had his aha moment. Yes, Chaim.
I think he saw the hypocrisy and the people not owning their stuff and the politics and the people out for their own agendas and just not caring about anybody else. So they, you know, he saw the corruptness and the garbage and the lies. So he had a moment of truth.
So he had this hatred that he had grown up with against the Jewish people, the Israelis, but he decided to do what? He went on a certain sort of a thought experiment. He went on a personal journey. What did he say he was going to do? He did something very interesting. He decided to, in a certain sense, he didn't say these words, but I'm going to rephrase it. He decided to be, in a certain sense, like a scientist. In other words, he had this hatred. He had this entire weight of a Hamas ideology that Israel is the devil. These people are evil incarnate. They want to destroy, and they're doing everything to destroy the Palestinian people and Islam in general. Yeah, they said, all right, that's how I brought up. He put that in a compartment, if you will. And then from firsthand experience, you want to say, well, let's see. Is this true? Are these people evil? Are they people who are hell-bent on trying to destroy the Palestinians? And he saw, even though he was in jail, he saw that these people are wanting to live a life of coexistence, want to live a decent life, and that then he became aware that basically by the demonization of Israel and Israeli people in general was really a cover for, as Chaim pointed out, all the corruption of the politicians and the, you know, and of the religious leadership of the Palestinians. In other words, they're using it as a blaming all the problems on the Israelis, and as Chaim said, they're not owning up to their own personal, corruption, their own lack, their own deficits, etc. So he had that epiphany about that basically what he was fed his whole life was fundamentally a lie, but a lie as an instrument to do what? To distract the people, the Palestinians, about the reality of their circumstances. That basically, that he says in another interview, where basically the Palestinian leadership has received billions of dollars of refugee funds, which gets funneled into the top 0.1% of the leadership, both religious and governmental. And the rest of the people are basically shafted. And who do they blame? It's the Israelis who's doing this for you. The Jews are doing this for you. And therefore, what you should do, we got to push them into the sea. So he had an epiphany. It didn't happen in one moment. It was a gradual thing, but there was one moment of an inflection point where he saw that was really sheker. He had the sheker awareness moment. He recognized that it was all really a lie. Okay, so why is this? What's so special about his transformation? He actually alluded to it in his presentation.
Well, because two things. Oh, go ahead.
And Dan Lastman in Oakland, California.
Well, two things. So one is that, to build on your point, he overcame, his lifelong indoctrination of, seeing the world from one perspective and really was able to, learn a new way of looking at things. So, really casting off all of that indoctrination over a lifestyle, but also more to the point, putting himself in a dangerous place because, people can realize they're doing something wrong and want to change it. But that's another thing to risk your life and literally stick your neck out there to be like speaking up about it, go public and be like, let's do this a different way.
All excellent points. He mentioned in his video, he says, why are the Palestinian people believing their religious leaders, their imam, the very sheikhs, the various governmental leaders? Because he makes the general point that people by and large are believers. So people believe what they're told. So he has sort of a flexibility of thought, as Dan so eloquently said. And even though knowing that coming to that awareness would put him in peril, he has there's a fatwa, there is a religious decree, it's a mitzvah to kill this guy. From the Hamas perspective, he has what they call a bounty on his head. This man cannot be strolling about. He could not, walk around. He's got to be concerned about his security 24/7. This guy is there's a marked man. He can't go to, many countries where he can't, because there are many people of Palestinian or Arabic origin that would want to basically take him out. So to come to an awareness, which actually is going to endanger your life, first of all, with the movie, I think it's on Netflix, you could check it up, about the Green Prince. But basically, he also worked as a spy and he saved a lot of people because of his information. A number of the suicide bomber plots were uncovered, and Imamish saved tons of people. And then he had to get, he got his cover got blown, or they got suspicious, and then he had to be ferreted out of there. But now he's spoken at the UN. He's spoken, if you'll do a little, basic search on the internet, he's spoken very publicly. But again, he's living a dangerous life, as Dan pointed out. So that's one thing, is to have an epiphany of an awareness that you've been fed, overcome an ideological being brainwashed, is point number one. And point number two is that even if it means at personal peril, excellent point. Now I want to go into bringing this a little closer to our Rosh Hashanah theme. Compare and contrast changing of a worldview versus changing of certain actions. Who can compare and contrast those two things?
Uh,
Well, I think the worldview, I'm sorry for lack of light. If you live in the dark world, then
no pun intended.
Then you know you might say it's not a worthwhile world to live in and work in, and you direct your energy against the system and you blame the system rather than assume personal responsibility. So in a sense, the way you see the metaphysics of the world, how our psyche operates, how our culture and nation operates, and to the extent that you put the blame or most of the blame into the system, it sort of gives you an excuse to say, you know, the system's rigged, so why even try?
Well, no, I'm not, that's a true point, but I'm talking about insofar as let me be more specific. What I'm trying to, we have the Green Prince, okay? He didn't just change an action for being a guy who does acts of hatred about the state of Israel. He changed his whole worldview that instead of Israel being evil, Israel is the good guy and Hamas the bad guy. And then from that followed, I want to support Israel. I want to speak up. I want to advocate upon Israel, and I want to speak out against the corruption of Hamas. That's what he did. Versus changing certain actions, which is a much more seemingly, you know, where a person is, you know, in this case, not berating Israel or not supporting Hamas. You know what I'm saying? There's a change of a worldview. Or, you know, let's take the case I'm back onto from a Jewish standpoint. You have a person who before was a secular Jew and they become an observant Jew. That's not a changing of actions. That's a changing of worldview. Versus a person who's changing certain actions is, let's say a person's an observant Jew. They're now doing more mitzvot or they're doing less mitzvot. You know what I'm saying? I want to get that locked down. What are the differences between that two stances?
So when it comes to specific actions, there's an element of instinct that's thrown into the mix of impulses, laziness, just purely instinctive, animalistic, reptilian-like influences that stand in between your beliefs and what you do. So if you want to get granular, I think that's the contrast. A big change in your worldview is going to lead to different actions. But as to the specifics of each action, those are going to be influenced by other factors. Other psychological factors.
True. Who else can want to clarify, compare and contrast the two? The distinction between a changing of a worldview and changing of certain actions. By way of analogy, we have the example would be by a computer. There is a difference between installing a new operating system. Let's say you're going from Windows 7 to Windows 10 or whatever the Apple equivalent is. Okay, that changes the entire framework. And then an action will be changing a particular piece of software. You know what I'm saying? A particular app, a particular program. So one level of, let's call it one kind of tshuva, is a changing of a worldview from going to from one standpoint point, in this case by the Green Prince over here. This person went from being a Rasha to a Tzaddik. Before, he was working to have suicide bombers blow themselves up in Israel. And now he became a person who's working to uncover and defeat that there should be suicide bombers. He wasn't doing because he's being bribed to do these particular things, because he recognized that he had been fed a falsehood. And he therefore his entire operating system changed. He went from being a devotee, an ideologue, a lover of Hamas to an enemy of Hamas. Okay? And from that, certain actions flowed from it. Now I'm speaking up for Israel. I'm uncovering what Hamas is trying to do, trying to speak to the world that they are involved. They're a corrupt institution. So conversely, when it comes to all areas of tshuva, there are two kinds of tshuva. One tshuva is within a system. Oh, let's say I learned one time a week, and now I want to move it up to twice a week. You know what I'm saying? One time I only learned, I davened on Shabbos. Now I'm going to daven on Shabbos and on Sunday, okay? But you're still within the realm of a person who is trying to be the more serious Jew they can, but they're still within a given system. Versus a person who's making a sea change based upon an aha moment, they see the world differently, and then the new lifestyle unfolds from that. Okay, is that distinction clear up before we go on? Sean? Dan?
Yeah.
Is that clear? Not clear. I need a little feedback here. I'm talking in the ether.
It's clear now. I like those analogies with the computer. That was good.
Okay, good. So, again, there's a distinction between a person who was, let's say we have a Jew who grew up secular, didn't know anything, and then they get an education. They get to that moment where they want to become a Baal Tshuva, and they become Shomer Shabbos. That's not simply a change in action. That's a change in lifestyle, worldview. That's a much bigger change. That's a paradigm. Use fancy words. That's a paradigm shift. That's a change of worldview. That's a change of identity. That's a good way of talking about it. One is a change. That would be a better way of talking about it. Let me make it, I think, more clear. There is change which is emerging from a change of identity, and then there's a change that is within the given identity, increase or decrease of certain action. You know what I'm saying? So what we call sociologically a Baal Tshuva. Every Jew has to be a Baal Tshuva. That's what Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur is all about. But we call a Baal Tshuva essentially what's happening is a change of identity. And therefore, from that comes a change of community. And what comes from that is a change of lifestyle. See how that flows? It's a big change. While within, a person is, let's say, observant, then they're trying to improve. I want to say less Lashon Hara. I want to give more tzedakah. I want to do more learning. I want to be involved in chesed more. You know what I'm saying? Those are within the identity. They're making a certain improvement within an identity. One's going from a shifting of identity, and one is within the identity to make an enhancement within a given identity. Would you say, is that a clear way of saying it? What do you guys say? Scott, what do you say, Scott?
Yeah, I think it's a good analogy.
Okay.
I think the book Atomic Habits says that when a habit is so ingrained, you stop from going to the gym to becoming an athlete.
That's very perfect. That's perfect. In other words, Shayna is not a person who goes to CrossFit, who goes, does the activities of going to CrossFit. She is a CrossFit athlete. In other words, that's her identity. And from that, of course, that person goes to the gym. Of course, that person has the right equipment. Of course, that person is concerned about what they eat. You know, there's a whole lifestyle that comes from that identity. It's not an action of, I went to the CrossFit gym and I lifted up these series of weights for this amount of time, and then I went home. Okay? Do you understand that distinction? So the green
print, more serious of a hobby kind of thing?
But it goes from the identity of like, there's a guy, I'm going to use, Adrian gave a good example by the Atomic Habits, which is one of my favorite secular reads of the last of 2021, is that basically you can pick up the guitar. Okay, there's a moment on it when you're going to be playing your guitar and you'll be learning, you'll be playing a D chord. And then there'll be a point where you're going to be playing to the degree where you go from being a person who's doing playing chords to you become a musician. There's a God, there's a time where you're going to be playing ball in the gym when you become
an athlete. Can you give us some example of what a musician would sound like?
Say it again?
Would you give us some example of what a musician would sound like?
Oh, yeah, like that. So you're going from just practicing individual chords and scales, and then there's a bit that becomes, it becomes not just an activity. You're going for, you're shifting from activity and habit to identity. And so far as the Green Prince, he did the ultimate tshuva. He went from the identity of being a child of Hamas to a supporter of Israel. And that's a radical change of identity. That's the most intense level of tshuva, from Rasha to Tzaddik. But even within a person's a good person, to go and change to certain identities with, you know, sub-identities. Because a person could be just, a person has multiple identities. You could be an athlete and a musician and a business person and a community involved person. There are different sub-identities you could have. Okay, so that's the background I want to sort of get into. So everything we have, that identity, action and habit to identity. Okay, let's keep on going. Now, just to go into the question, do we have to be afraid on Rosh Hashanah? So the Ram has a simple, interesting halacha. Marvin Bavakasha, read it out to everybody.
From Rambam?
Yeah.
Okay. Hallel is not recited on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, since they are days of repentance, awe, and fear, and are not days of extra simcha. Just a little side question there, because I was pre-reading it before. We do say Hag Sameach, but it's not extra simcha. It's just like a basic level of simcha for the holiday.
Excellent question. So Rosh Hashanah is a complex holiday. On one hand, it's a Yom Tov. In other words, you're allowed to cook on Rosh Hashanah, right? You're allowed to carry on Rosh Hashanah like a regular, like Pesach, Shavuot, and Sukkot. But it also has this, let's call this very heavy themes of accepting God's kingship. There's a recognition of, there are many, many heavy, very heavy themes. The most heaviest themes are expressed in the Machzor, judgment. We're going to explore one most famous and heaviest poems, which was inserted in the Middle Ages in the Ashkenazic Siddurim, the Lasana Tokef. We'll get into that. So therefore, there's a joy and there's a sense of recognition of God, and therefore that creates a sense of reverence. It's sort of like, makes it sort of like a, it tones down. It's sort of a simcha, but there's a somberness. There's a very serious note to it. You know what I'm saying? So while Pesach, Shavuot, and Sukkot is simcha of celebrating God's relationship to the Jewish people, either because he took us out of Egypt or he gave us the Torah at Mount Sinai, or he took care of us in the desert time. So it's a celebration of the loving relationship of Hashem, period, full stop. There's no fear or awe involved. Rosh Hashanah has the sense that there's a Yom HaDin, it's a day of judgment. It's the first day of the 10 days of repentance. And if you just read the Machzor, it has extremely heavy duty themes that sort of like make it more somber. Okay, we don't fast on Rosh Hashanah, although interesting, there were people who did fast on Rosh Hashanah. It was a custom. Okay, at least by day, not at night. All right, so let's go on. Now we'll get to one of the most and to pick this up even further. There's a famous passage in the Talmud. So Marvin, read it out.
Rabbi Kruspe Pedai said that Rabbi Yochanan said, three books are open on Rosh Hashanah before the Holy One, blessed be he. One of holy, wicked people, and one of holy righteous people, and one of middling people whose good and bad deeds are equally balanced. Holy righteous people are immediately written and sealed for life. Holy wicked people are immediately written and sealed for death. And middling people are left with their judgment suspended from Rosh Hashanah until Yom Kippur, their fate remaining undecided. If they merit through the good deeds and mitzvot that they are that they perform during this period, they are written for life. If they do not so merit, they are written for death.
Okay, this is the famous you know, this is a midrashic depiction of, you know, the judgment on Rosh Hashanah. Now, God's not physical. He doesn't have books. He doesn't need books, but it's trying to give it in sort of a human kind of way of what a judgment is. Okay. And this idea is expanded in the Middle Ages by the Nisana Toka prayer, which is said in the Musaf, of the Amidah, the Musaf prayer. So let's read this out. This is I'm sure you've heard this before. All right, Marvin, take it away.
Nutatna Tokev prayer. We lend power to the holiness of this day, for it is tremendous and awe-filled, and on it your kingship will be exalted, your throne will be established in loving kindness, and you will sit on that throne in truth. It is true that you are the one who judges and reproves, who knows all and bears witness, who inscribes and seals, who reckons and enumerates. You remember all that is forgotten. You open the book of records, and from it all shall be read. In it lies each person's signature, and with a great shofar it is sounded, and a thin, silent voice shall be heard. And the angels shall be alarmed, and dread and fear shall seize them as they proclaim, "Behold, the day of judgment on which the host of heaven shall be judged, for they too shall not be judged blameless by you, and all creatures shall parade before you as a herd of sheep. As a shepherd herds his flock, directing his sheep to pass under his staff, so do you shall pass, count, and record the souls of all living, and decree a limit to each person's days, and inscribe their final judgment. On Rosh Hashanah it is inscribed, and on Yom Kippur it is sealed. How many shall pass away, and how many shall be born? Who shall live and who shall die? Who in good time and who by an untimely death? Who by water and who by fire? Who by sword and who by wild beast? Who by famine and who by thirst? Who by earthquake and who by plague? Who by strangulation and who by stoning? Who shall have rest and who wander? Who shall be at peace and who pursued? Who shall be serene and who shall be tormented? Who shall become impoverished and who wealthy? Who shall be debased and who exalted? But repentance, prayer, and righteousness avert the severity of the decree.
Okay. Have you got, raise your hand if you have, if you recall this poem, which is mentioned in the Amidah. It's written, we have it both in the Musaf of Rosh Hashanah, both days, and the Musaf of Yom Kippur. Shane remembers it. Who else remembers this? All right, so on Rosh Hashanah it's inscribed, and on Yom Kippur it's sealed. Rosh Hashanah yikasei vun, v'yom tzom kippur yikasei mun. The song. All right, Dan, last one is I got a thumbs up from him. Okay, so this is a, for Judaism it's modern, maybe the 13th, 14th century. But obviously it's poetically building out what Ralph Crispadoy said about the various books. Okay.
Rabbi, I have a side question, though, because this is a topic that is current for, I think, everybody as we watch TV and we think about the Taliban and what's happening on in Afghanistan. Yep. Where we talk about the stoning and things that we in our more modern society consider to be so repulsive and right. So backwards. Brutal.
Yeah.
How do we interpret this? Because Judaism seems to be very docile. In comparison, and although there's certainly judgment within communities and people judge, you know, everything from, you know, what clothes they're wearing and other things like that to how they behave or how they when I say clothes, like also if they're modest or not modest, or if they're showing off that they're wealthy or not. But, you know, this is a different type of judgment that we don't practice these days.
Is this a human judgment? Who's doing the judging here? This is a judgment of Hashem.
Right, but we're talking about stoning, so that makes it very
That person will, you know, you would call basically what makes this, what the reason why this poem sort of sticks in people's minds, because it makes it very granular. Not that a person's going to be, as the other one said, sealed for life and sealed for death. He said, not only that, who's going to die, who in a good time, who's untimely death, and not only that, by water, that means drowning, or by fire, God forbid, person stuck in a burning out house, by sword, you know, like as he said, and going back to, you know, to in a war zone, or by wild beasts, it happens all the time, by famine, by thirst, earthquake, plague, unfortunately, plague, 2021 and 2020, essentially millions of people have died by plague called COVID. Okay, so it's not by strangulation. People, you know, these things happen not so frequently. It doesn't mean it's done by any kind of court. I'm talking about people die in very sometimes unusual ways. But the Python, the poem, the person, the author of this poem, which got inserted into the Musa prayer, is trying to bring to mind sort of like the reality of God's judgment. You know, he's taken this Gemara over here from Rosh Cruspidoy, sealed for life, sealed for death, then that whole issue there, and making it very what? Making it very real and granular, okay? Okay, so now which gets to my question is, what is so scary about the Nisan HaTokev prayer? I remember as a little boy, I'm going to give you a story. Always have a good story. So I grew up in Seattle, Washington. Like every shul in the world, but certainly when I was growing up, our shul would balloon in size by people we did not see the rest of the year. Okay? Every seat was filled. These were people who are members of the Orthodox shul, but themselves were not Orthodox, but the shul they go to was an Orthodox shul, okay? And I remember when the chazan would be singing, you know, who will die, who in a good time, who will untimely death, I remember being standing next to like elderly people, and this poem really, it had real resonance. There was a palpable fear of the reality that life is short. There's a real sense of their mortality. And this poem gave voice to sort of the scarier thoughts of life. I mean, look, I myself, just to give you another dramatic point here, is that Marvin, you were there. You helped do the mitzvah. We had, unfortunately, in the greater MG community, a husband, a 54-year-old husband of a woman who was in the fellowship year one, who I officiated their wedding 8 years ago. We buried him, and he died from COVID, and he was a healthy person, but he just got a terrible case of COVID, and he had that real cascading of conditions, and they couldn't save them. So there are certain very scary realities out there, and the Nisan HaTokev brings that out. I remember people, when this is being, you know, sung, it would make people feel very it would bring to mind those things, those thoughts about the scary parts of life that people push out of their mind. You know what I'm saying?
The unfortunate thing is, when we go back a couple weeks ago and you were talking about my unorthodox life, and you have somebody who's saying, you know, that Jews are extremists just like Christians and Muslims, and yet we see Muslims, you know, chopping off hands and throwing in boiling water and killing or hurting children and women and girls just for going to school. So, you know, when you see this kind of language, which does reflect back to that, someone who is less educated, I appreciate your explanation there. But someone who's less attuned to it, like the woman Julia Hart, this is something that she would use against why you should be connected with the religious Jewish community, how we're extreme, just like the Taliban are extreme.
Right. Well, this is not, we're not saying here that this is what we should do. We're saying that this is, these are realities of life. And I think going back to your first example, Marvin, that one of the most saddest things of the situation is that 1 minute to midnight today, earlier today in Kabul, Afghanistan, the last, flight left Kabul International Airport. And unfortunately, there were people who helped the Americans who are being left to the quote-unquote mercies of the Taliban, which is not known for their great mercy. So it's not a good situation. And then, but what we're talking about is that there's a judgment, there's an inscription, and there's a judgment here. Okay. There's so much to talk about, but, we don't have too many hours tonight. I'm going to get down to we always close at 9:15. So, what is the Book of Records and why is everyone's signature in it? What is the author referencing? What's the record of records? What is that metaphorically trying to say?
You're talking about you're inscribed in the Book of Life, right?
Well, but what it says, you're opening the Book of Records. Well, the Hebrew is a Sefer HaZichronot, the Book of Remembrances. What is that referring to?
It's our actions, the actions that we take and that we sign our name to, whether it be something bad or good.
Exactly. In other words, it's saying obviously God's omniscient. He does not need a book, and we're not asked to sign off on it. But it's saying, as it were, there is a record of all human action. And as Marvin said, our good actions and our bad actions. And we're all recorded in it, okay? The Sefer HaZichronot. The Sefer HaZichronot is a term we see eloquently in the Megillat Esther, when King Achashver can't sleep and he says to his personal assistant, bring out the Sefer HaZichronot and read me some of the things that have been done on my behalf. And lo and behold, they pull out the book, open the page. Oh, let me tell you the story about this guy, Mordechai, who basically saved your life, uncovered a assassination plot. Oh, and what happened? And was he rewarded? No. Sefer HaZichronot, okay? That's word from Tanakh. That's where the author of the poem borrows from Tanakh, obviously. Borrows from Tanakh, borrows from the Gemara. He's putting it all together here. Okay. Anyway, so it's as Marvin said, it's basically the recollection. Now here's it. This is sort of the interesting question. Question number six. I think one of the main points of tonight. Why are we judged together with all of society and all the deeds of society? It's not God judges us individually. Notice he's judging us. You remember all that's for God. You open the Book of Records, and from it shall be read lies each person's signature. Okay? And everybody passes as a shepherd. Okay? Basically, everybody's being judged. All creatures. Everybody. Why are we being judged as part of all humanity?
We're responsible for each other.
Okay, good. But there are many points to this. Okay, so you're saying, all right. So how does that influence the idea or reflect the idea of a judgment? How does that? Go ahead.
I'm just thinking about connecting back to the Green Prince a little bit. That it's, you know, when you have someone who's had that sea change in their life and now they're an activist for, you know, peace or life as opposed to darkness and death, like how do you actually receive that person? Do you say, oh, that's good news, you know, great, I'm glad one person flipped to our side? Or do you, you know, kind of pick up their torch and promote their story as well? So it's like how do you take good news and bad news? And, you know, it also kind of reminds me of Lashon Hara and just generally, like, how do we behave in our larger social circles, and how does that reverberate outward into the world? Like, we're supposed to be the light unto nations. Are we really, you know, picking up and doing our work every day for that.
So, okay, I like what you said, but just let's, so Dan, unpack it a little further. So therefore, why is it, why would quote unquote God judge all creatures, all people collectively? I want to say that everybody individually is judged, but in other words, why is it there's a judgment of all humanity? What's that getting on? So Marvin said, because we're all responsible for one another.
Yeah, I mean, similar to that, we're all responsible for each other. If someone is, you know, doing a great job of, you know, being a rabbi or being an activist for good and hesed and tzedakah in one way or another, like, are we treating that person with apathy? Or are we trying to, you know, rally around them and spread, you know, like in the days before the internet, so to speak, you know, it was word of mouth. So it's dependent on society of really carrying on those kind of good works and one generation to the next. So all of society is being judged because they're being judged on how are they, you know, are they standing on the shoulders of giants or are they, you know, getting underfoot?
Dan, well said. We both, what Dan and what Marvin pointed out, nobody lives in an island. What we do has much influence on our friends, our family, and by extension, our society, both negatively and positively. Okay, so therefore, you're being assessed not just as an individual, but also in a systemic realm. Two is also you're judged based upon the level of everybody else. In other words, are you being judged? You know, where are you relative to everybody else? In other words, we have to be the best version of ourselves, but we also are assessed upon based upon where is society? You know what I'm saying? It, in a certain sense, it's not necessarily a person's fault if they're born into a terrible society, or conversely, they're held to a greater level of responsibility if they're in a great place and they don't pick up that opportunity, as Dan was mentioning. You know what I'm saying? There's a context, to put it in one sentence, there's a context to the judgment. We are not only our own people. We are people whose actions and lives has profound impact on the people around us and beyond, both positively. You can do one action, well, that somebody else gets inspired to also do that chesed and that kindness and then share that word of Torah and that wisdom, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know what I'm saying? The judgment is a much more holistic perspective because you're not just one person in the totality of the universe. So A, your impact is societal, both to you, and conversely, since you're also impacted and influenced by society, you're judged relative in a certain sense to what everybody else is doing. And furthermore, our actions have a profound impact. I mean, let's give a simple example. What would be the consequence of a family raising a child and sending them to get a quality Jewish education versus raising a child and not giving that child a quality Jewish education? What is the consequence of that? Well, that's huge. That one action has huge reverberation, not just to that child, but for many generations after that. So there's a, you know, like for example, in some corporate structures, they assess the person, like what they call a 360 evaluation. Are you guys familiar with that? The boss gives an assessment, the colleagues give an assessment, and the people that who are the subordinates of the employee. So they sort of get a 360 perspective of the person. You know what I'm saying? Well, that's showing that there's different aspects to a person, but conversely, what a person does and influences people and influence others has many, many facets and features. So that's the key element. The judgment is a much more sophisticated judgment because our impact on the world is complex. And can influence lots of people, both positively and conversely negatively. So it's a judgment of the society and the deeds of society. Now, what people do you think we are misperceiving, like the Green Prince misperceived the state of Israel initially? Person's parents, that annoying friend, our rabbi, and our boss. Gave examples here. So that all of us, we all are, and here's a great quote from Mark Twain. When I was a boy of 14, my father was so ignorant, I could hardly stand to have that old man around. But when I got to be 21, I was astonished at how much the old man had learned in 7 years. So the point being is that in our assessment of things, on our judgment of others, we don't have the wisdom of Hashem, obviously. Oftentimes, we might misperceive and judge others in a very narrow way. So, for example, how do people misperceive their parents frequently? What's a classic misperception of a person's parents?
That they don't understand.
Okay.
Like, you don't understand.
Is it? Well, first of all, I mean, it is possible that the parents don't understand, but is it possible that the parents do understand, or we don't think they don't understand?
We don't think they understand.
But why is that?
Because we're just like, because we're trying to like justify our actions based on what we want or how we feel against like their wishes.
Yes. Right. So a person might look at their parents and negate who they are and what they believe because they might stand in the way of what we want to do. Now, they could be wrong. I mean, I'm not saying that parents are omniscient, right. You know, but there is a chance that we are not going to judge them favorably and misperceive them. Also, the annoying friend. We have a friend who could be annoying. You may have a friend who you might be annoying sometimes. And why would we misperceive them initially? What's lacking? What's lacking to go beyond the annoyingness of our friend to perceive them properly? As the Green Prince went from their initial assessment of Israel to his later assessment of Israel.
I was, going to say empathy. I mean, sometimes we get mad at our friends for things that we don't like about ourselves. So in the Green Prince example, it's like, oh, you know, you're attacking us and killing our women and children. It's like, well, you're also attacking our women and children. We don't like that either, you know? So it's cuts both ways.
Correct. We also will see their actions in a certain way, and we don't provide a broader picture. Well, let's ask why they might be annoying because what they're going through is an extremely stressful circumstance in their life right now. We're not willing to cut them any, you know, be empathetic or understanding because they're just like, you're annoying me, get out of my face. Okay. While if we had a sympathy and understanding of what's going on in their life, in other words, to stop to see what's going on in their lives and therefore have an appreciation and therefore give an understanding of what they're going through and therefore not view it as they're being annoying to me. They're just overwhelmed with the sorrows of their circumstance and you'd have a much different response. You know, people misperceive rabbis. We mentioned this a couple of weeks ago, whatever, that in classic Jewish communities, the topic which is frequently on a Shabbos afternoon would be the rabbi and the classic thing, you know, the rabbi, he spoke too long, he spoke too short, it was still, you know, some criticism, you know what I mean, And we discussed that a number of weeks ago. Why is the rabbi frequently being misperceived, the congregational rabbi?
People have thoughts and expectations of what the rabbi should be or what they think the rabbi should be. When the rabbi doesn't fit into like their definition or their box of this is a rabbi, that's one of the issues.
Well said, Shana.
I was going to say, just jokingly, politics, but usually if it's politics that you don't agree with.
Right, exactly. Right. he might be supporting something that some of the congregants support, and because you don't support that particular initiative, for that reason, Dan, just let you know, I will never voice openly any of my personal political considerations, Democratic or Republican, because I don't want to alienate 50% of any class. So I always take the stance of neutrality, because it's gonna annoy or alienate 50% of the class. Why would I do that? So I try to remain politically neutral as much as I can. But not for the support of the state of Israel. That, of course, I am very much. So there's a misperception of the rabbi. And also the thing, as was mentioned, this is not this class, but in classes past, the bottom line is that the rabbi is an authority figure. People don't like the authority figure. People have problems with their father. He's a kind of father. Therefore, they will judge him from that perspective. They will, you know, he's annoying because he's asserting an authority. Similarly to the person's boss. Person will be overwhelmingly, if anybody's worked in a company situation, do you hear people say, you know, my boss is amazing, so wise, so considerate, so understanding, such a pleasure to be with. Have you heard that said by? I actually have. I just had a boss retire. We had a farewell thing, and we did say that to him, but it's so exceptional. It's like the absolute, exception to the rule. Why do people love to get around the old kitchen area, the office kitchen area with a cup of coffee and say, and trash talk about the boss? Why is that like a certified enjoyment?
I don't know. It's kind of like team. It's like a team bonding experience, I guess.
The team bonding experience that we like to trash talk to the boss. Why is that? Why is that the joy?
Lashon Hara?
Yes, but it is Lashon Hara, but it's a certain particular enjoyable variety of Lashon Hara. Because the bottom line is, again.
Well, I mean, it's easy to, you know, harp on the guy who's asking people to stay late or come in on a Sunday or whatever. You know what I mean? Even though it's for the good of their jobs, even though if they don't know it.
Right. Bottom line is that this guy is asking me to do stuff that I don't want to do. Okay. And that's intrinsically annoying. And, you know, and oftentimes their decisions that they make, which are going to be unpopular because not everybody knows what's going on in the totality of the company, that makes that really pertinent and relevant. So, so obviously there's not going to be a person's going to look at the person in a very narrow fashion. Therefore, they're not going to be able to see a broader perspective and judge them essentially, properly. So, Here's another one. How does the portrayal of Frank and Estelle Costanza in Seinfeld reinforce the general feelings on TV that parents are annoying fools? In general, on TV, there's always a, at least in the sitcom world, parents are pretty much depicted in one fashion. This is, of course, an extreme version. Why is that?
The interaction is entertaining, and we can all see ourselves to some extent in those situations.
100%. There's the reason why it's entertaining, the reason why it's enjoyable, is because all of us feel about our parents, lesser or greater degree, that they are annoying fools, and are clueless and don't get it, and make arbitrary rules that don't make any sense. You know, like famous Frank Costanza, Festivus, a Festivus for the rest of us. You know, he makes, you know, nutty things. That is a, you know, a characterization. And again, a misperception. So again, going to our notion of the Green Prince, having an aha moment of when you're an, or Mark Twain, when his father went from being a old fool to a highly educated person, because when you get older, you start to appreciate the complexity of life, and you start to see, you know, I understand why my parents are the way they are. And I recognize that some of the things they did, even though at the time I felt was stupid, is actually quite wise. That doesn't mean they don't make mistakes, but it just, there's an appreciation when you become a little older, recognize the complexity of life, you'll be able to understand them in a better and a much more charitable way. Okay. Bringing it back home. We got 3 minutes left. Here we go. Case one, aha moments about kashrut. What mistaken belief do people who do not keep kosher about this mitzvah think of eating lobster, as an example? What do shomer kashrut know about this mitzvah? In other words, what is the aha moment that people have when they transition from being people who do not keep kosher to people who now keep kosher? There's an aha moment, like the Green Prince. What is that? What would you say is that? What were some of the aha moments that you would that you can identify here?
Well, I can speak to this one since I grew up eating lobster, that I grew up to know that it's delicious.
Lobster is delicious.
It's just like a great way to deliver butter right into the system.
Right. The best butter delivery system there is. Okay. So, but what is the moment that a person recognizes, I know that lobster is delicious, but I'm not going to eat lobster anymore? Or what is the, there's an epiphany. There's an aha moment. There's an insight, like the Green Prince, that has to happen to change from being going from a lobster eater to a non-lobster eater because of kashrut. What is that aha moment?
Is it that like you find out that they're kind of like you know the rules of like kashrut, like why you can only eat fish with like gills and scales, and this doesn't have that. And sometimes, like catfish, it's considered like a bottom feeder creature.
So you're saying that the aha moment is an education. I recognize that there's a wisdom to the laws of kashrut, and therefore this is not kosher. And therefore, I'm not that I'm denying myself lobster. I'm rather trying to live a better life, which does not include lobster. It's not like it's an anti-lobster religion.
Well, there's rules behind it. There's like, you know, evidence behind it. It's not some great rabbi, some sage from 3,000, 4,000 years ago had a lobster and just didn't like it. So he said, nobody else can eat lobster.
Right, correct. Right, there's a an awareness about the wisdom behind the laws of kashrut, not that it's arbitrarily selected. No lobster. Okay, that's good. Anybody want to add to that?
I like the approach. But I was going to say the other side of the coin is to just go with the non-rational approach and just kind of more faith-based, that, you know, it says not to do it, and I believe in the, you know, divine revelation of the kashrut laws, and I'm just going to stick with it. It's, you know, it's like a discipline commitment.
Right. So what about in order to be so that already so the aha moment wasn't really about the kashrut. It's about I'm accepting the truthfulness of the Torah, and part yeah. And a consequence of that is that I'm going to now be live a kosher lifestyle.
Yeah, I was at my Mount Sinai, and I'm bound by these rules, whether I understand it or not.
Okay, good. Also, there's a recognition is that what, like when I'm throughout the fellowship, we're going into, I think, year 15, 14, 15, I'm not sure, that there's an awareness like, if I don't have this, even though I felt my life was so enhanced by lobster, and or some people it's a certain kind of pizza, pepperoni pizza, other people it's the BLT, whatever their favorite food is. But when I don't have it, my life is not, it's not like I am now become an empty shell of a person. I can still have a robust life without, there's an awareness that when you're a non-shomer kosher, I can't even imagine not having lobster or pepperoni pizza or BLT sandwiches, okay? Then there's awareness I don't have, I have now for these reasons that Scott and Dan shared, I don't feel fundamentally lacking. There's another thing is that there's an imagining that I can't live a complete life. I don't have if I'm unable to eat this. There's a sort of a fear that my life will completely stink. Like there was one guy, no names mentioned, but they just loved a certain kind of Brooklyn pizza. Brooklyn, of course, has some of the finest pizza in America. At least that's what the people of Brooklyn tell us. So Italian. Classic Italian pizza, et cetera. And the guy was like, that was his big moment. But then he got to the point that he recognized, like, if I don't have it, my life is still, I can live a meaningful life without that. I'm not fundamentally disadvantaged. Okay, so the similar things, I mean, I don't want to keep everybody late. Aha moments by Shabbat, aha moments by Native non-Jews, aha moments by learning Torah. There are certain moments that a person recognizes that that's something important to them, and that not having it, not having it will be a real loss. So there's aha moment. So basically, to put it all together in 30 seconds, we're about to have Rosh Hashanah. There's the blowing of the shofar. There's the recognition of the judgment of all of humanity. There's a recognition of trying to have change. There's different kinds of change. Change level one is a changing within a specific identity. And then there's a change like the Green Prince, which is a changing of identity. Hamas to pro-Israel. Or in this case, is a person who is not Shomer Kashrut to Shomer Kashrut. Not Shomer Shabbat to Shomer Shabbat. Person who dates all people, person who dates only Jews, person who does not learn Torah, person who learns Torah. These are not changes of actions, but also sort of changes of identity. You know what I mean? In the same person who does not exercise, now I'm an athlete at CrossFit. Okay, these are changes of not just actions, but identity. And what we're hearing the show for is not it's to explore areas where we can improve a little bit to develop the actions, the habits, and ultimately identity of a new and improved version of ourselves. That's what Rosh Hashanah is about. And that's why it's serious, because I don't want to waste this is a big moment. I want to take it very seriously. So Rosh Hashanah, it's a Yom Tov, but it's a serious Yom Tov. Because you think about the totality of your life, where have you been? What good things did you accomplish this year? What do you want to accomplish for the coming year? Recognizing that life is shorter than we think. And how can we make the changes that really bring out our best? Those are some of the thoughts to have come up for Rosh Hashanah. So I want to wish everybody a Shana Tova, a Kesima Siva Toma, and hope to see some people tomorrow night at 131 West 86th Street when we have our little reunion. And I guess we'll have a little Zoom session. We'll Zoom as well, because we'll do a little conversation about different aspects of Rosh Hashanah that we didn't touch on tonight. All right, guys. Have a wonderful night.
Thank you. Shana Tova, everybody.
Shana Tova, everyone.
Shana Tova.
Thank you, Rabbi.
All the best. Bye.